Hello everyone, welcome on an official podcast. Today we have a very interesting topic of the discussion, which will be around development operation, and everyone usually knows this by name DevOps. We might as well talk about DevSecOps and what it is. Let's see in the later of our discussion how that sec, that security comes into the picture and how we, what actually we can do with it. But before that, I actually wanted to ask Peter, because we were preparing for this podcast and he shared some very interesting story that I want you all to hear about. So Peter, do you have any fun stories from the DevOps domain?
Yeah, this is way before Salesforce space, and the guy I actually still work now 20 years later, and I had worked for this company whose name will remain nameless, but it was a government gig. And we were setting up internal networking and structure for basically file storage for our dev teams so that they can actually have larger files to store and save and internal networking stuff so that like they can share files between each other. And then we were specifically working on getting just setting up project structures and like figuring out how all that stuff is going to work for whenever somebody has a new client. And then how the file sharing between the customer and the client was all going to work, things like that. And then how, more specifically, like how we were going to manage projects internally just with those files. And then ended up being a internal like network, like files, the old school stuff that like everyone within the same company had the same, you know, like folder that showed up on their desktop that had all the projects in it. And one of our clients had called one day to try to get some backup copies of projects as more of the stuff that we had helped try to set up internally for the project. And everything was gone and deleted. And they were like, where's our stuff? And it's like, we had the only copy, like period, of everything for the projects that we've been working on for years. So we went to our project manager and we're like, hey, so where, what happened to our stuff here? She's like, you know, do you know anything about this? And she's like, oh yeah, it was on my computer. I just deleted it. I was like, wait, what do you mean your computer? You were on the network drive. She's like, no. I mean my computer. I was on my computer and I saw it on there, and I don't need it on my computer, so I just deleted it. And this is, you know, Unix based stuff. So back then it was like, when I deleted it, it was deleted. And it was like, that was our actual backup. And so it was the only place that it existed. And so 2 years worth of stuff is just gone. And it was the whole thing that I was trying to get set up for our company was back then was that, like, you know, we didn't have very good file storage systems. We didn't have, and this is, you know, we were working with like Macromedia, like Director and Flash. And so it had a lot of large video content. So it was mostly trying to figure out like whenever, how all that stuff was going to get saved for development teams and things like that, and how we're going to deploy it. And it was kind of agreed that the cheapest solution was just to have this one internal drive that was kind of accessible to everyone. And then, yeah, it just got trashed and gone and no backups. So they were like, what do we do? She's like, well, it's like 2 years worth of work. There's not a lot we can do. It's just gone. Like, unless somebody's got a copy of it somewhere, like we can try to get it off the drive. But, you know, it's going to be this whole thing. It's like, it was not pretty. So not like modern day like DevOps stuff. But back then it was more definitely like trying to figure out how larger projects that have a large, like several gigabytes worth of video content, and how you're going to save all of that stuff for a project, and how you're going to share stuff between clients, and how all that got deployed. It was very much an internal part of the developer's job to like kind of architect that internally with the team to like figure out how that was going to go. And wasn't never planning on somebody just straight up trashing things back then, but that was their budget, isn't it? One hard drive internally for everybody, and we're like, we should probably actually have more backups than that. No, that's fine. And it wasn't. So good stuff.
It's good that no one, you know, that we have those recordings when no one can see me, because I was laughing. I was literally laughing like in the background. Even the story have a, you know, a sadness behind it that the work was lost. But I guess it's like we repeated multiple times in several podcasts. You never lose, right? You either win or learn. So I guess it was a great learning in terms of, hey, you need to have several backups. Don't store.
You would think that what they ended up doing after this is, when we made a request for the actual backup, they sent us a tape drive in a computer, or like in an old computer, in a box full of packing peanuts that was loose. And then so when we got it, it was, you know, we opened it up and we're like, what is this? It's like, oh, it's your backup stuff. I'm like, this is just like a really old computer with like a tape, like an old school tape drive that had like 2 megabytes of space on it. They're like, well, this is what we use internally. So this is the government, you know, back 20 years ago. They're like, yeah, it should be fine for what you guys, we use them for backups all the time. We're like, no, you don't, we're doing like video and like high-end stuff. Like we really needed to actually have like a proper storage solution. They're like, so do you need more tape drives? I'm like, no, we don't need tape. We need like actual hard drives here. And they didn't understand. So it was like a total internal. This was like, you know, when this stuff was just coming out and people were kind of moving into like the Web 2.0 stuff. And it was just ridiculous. So it was just trying to be a part of that process and planning all that stuff out and getting the companies to understand like what you needed was more like pulling teeth than it is these days. So. Yeah, it's good stuff.
Great story. Thank you, Peter.
Sure.
Today with me and Peter, we have Kyle Montgomery. Can you introduce yourself? Just a short story about yourself for anyone who might not know you.
Yes, thank you. I'm happy to join the podcast today. My name is Kyle Montgomery. I'm VP Engineering at Astound Commerce, VP Engineering for North America. And I started in the Demandware / Salesforce Commerce Cloud space about 8 or 9 years ago. I got hired by a customer as a .NET developer and a SQL database developer, Oracle developer to handle their middleware, but they were a new Demandware customer. It was Deckers Outdoor Corporation here in Flagstaff, Arizona, where I am. And you know, Deckers really did it right. They treated their people great, and they just paid for my Demandware developer training right away. They flew me out to Burlington, Massachusetts in my first few months at the job, and I learned this new thing called Demandware. And that's been a real turning point in my career. I've embraced the technology since, and it's been hopefully mutually beneficial. But I really enjoy Demandware and Salesforce Commerce Cloud. And that's a little about me.
Cool. So if I heard correctly, 9 years from developer to VP of engineering, right? Like that's the timeline.
That was my crazy fortunate career path. Sure. I don't. The job title is one thing. I think of myself as a solution architect. And that's okay. Within the Commerce Cloud space, that's a perfectly fine description for me.
Yeah, still, it's amazing. I usually like very amazed of the people who are able to get, you know, to the great successes. I usually say that, yes, we do have, each of us has its own pace. But when I hear like those, you know, like, kind of short timelines and great successes, I'm just usually want to hear like the success stories, but maybe it's like after podcast discussion we may have. As of today, we will focus about development and operations topic. It's one of my best discussion that I like to talk about. And I cannot say that I was always the DevOps lover. I remember times when I was like in the beginning of my journey and I was telling like, why architects should know about DevOps? Like it's operations. We need to know how to build the stuff, right? That was that broken mindset where I said, like, even as a developer, I said, like, I don't need to know how it operates, how it's running. I just need to know how to build a function. Give me what you need. What your functional requirements? What tables do you need? Objects to build? What form? What data? I will do that. And I really didn't care about how what's done before after my ticket moved to testing. I know it's broken mindset, but still it was there. So Kai, what was in your life like? Was DevOps always a part of your agenda? And what actually is DevOps for you? I mean, what is maybe buzzword means?
Well, that's a great question. That's actually one of my favorite interview questions to give to candidates who want to join our company. So tell me, what is DevOps? What does it mean to you? And you get so many different answers. Some people will just recite tools. Oh, it's Puppet, it's Kubernetes, it's these kind of things, deployment management and tools like that. And then some people will not really know it at all, and that's okay. It's not a must-have for the job, but I just want to get a feel for the person, how they're following trends and you know, the general digital ecosystem. And because I asked that question, I have my favorite answer that I found somewhere on some blog post somewhere. I wish I could attribute it correctly. But my favorite answer is a little more abstract. DevOps is the harmony of people, processes, and tools to deliver value quickly. That's it. The way to get things from ideation to customer satisfaction, what that looks like, how to do it efficiently as possible. That's DevOps to me. In our world, software development, that means a real harmony between development and operations, which is where the term I think comes from.
I like this one. Peter, what do you think? Like, does it hit you like any other?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Tradition? That's exactly right. Well, and in my opinion, like DevOps can also be like just proper documentation. Like it's totally just like a it's yeah, Kyle's 100% right. It's more for like if you've got a team and you need to like they have repeated pain points or if you've got multiple teams that work within like on the same project where you know sometimes you've got like system operations and you've got a design team and you got a development team and then there's communication that happens between that and so sometimes you need to actually build tooling for handoff between those people and sometimes there's just documentation that needs to be done on like how to get set up and running. So it's more of just in my opinion solving the problems that like get in everybody's way and just let them do their job. And the best you can do that, like the better the company seems to go, especially like if you can bridge those gaps between the different like principles within the company of the, you know, the different tasks that everyone's working on and make that process run smoothly and put in kind of measures that during that handoff or even during the individual process that can catch regular errors or things that are going to break a process pretty quickly and just, you know, being able to better detect that and inform the person that what's going on. So, in my experience, I've even found just like with Salesforce recently, just proper documentation for how to stand up a sandbox all the way to like, if you're doing accessibility testing for front end development, like here's the different tools that you need. Here's how to get set up. Here's, you know, access to the different resources you're going to need so that, the onboarding for that stuff goes a lot faster. So all of that stuff kind of congeals together in that mindset of that harmony that Kyle was talking about for sure.
I have actually a question of you both. What then, we spoke about DevOps right now, what is for us, then how is security fitting into this one? Because there are two words in the domain, right? DevOps, usually use mostly DevOps, and some people say, okay, we have a next level, which is called DevSecOps. So what actually it is? Like, what's the difference between two of them? Like, does it mean that if I have, I don't know, testing some credit cards, if I will fill out my credit card data and then I don't see them in the log, it means that I already embedded security in my DevOps operations? Or it's something else, like what does it mean to have security as part of DevOps?
Well, here you're definitely challenging me, which is good. I like challenged. My understanding is DevSecOps, by adding that security part into the word, it's kind of a microcosm for what it's trying to do in DevOps as a whole, which is explicitly introduce security into the workflow, to not forget about it, to consciously include it. When you're thinking about DevOps, you need to think about security too. Because if you do, you will have more efficient quality. If you're able to explicitly look at and concern yourself about the security of your platform, the scalability of your platform, right from the beginning of establishing a DevOps flow, and calling it DevSecOps instead, you're innately going to include security in that. And that's kind of the point. Exploratory testing and penetration testing, introducing those. So not just unit testing, not just, you know, automated integration tests or functional tests, penetration tests, other kind of security tests. Get that in your workflow explicitly and make your CISO feel more comfortable.
It's actually, you know, it reminds me like about Agile and when people, because they want to secure the project, they're trying to put more procedures, all the stuff that like, oh, we have like, all additional stuff that is kind of, yeah, it's okay to have them. But if you're running in Agile, right, you want to actually focus on the value and not on the kind of a contract and procedures, right? You have moved that to the bottom of the priority list. And it's, I guess it's similar to here, right? Security is part of DevOps, but people who are actually explicitly reminding about security in the name, right? They maybe not were doing DevOps in the right way, or they didn't succeed and they wanted to put sec as part of it just to remind everyone else. I like this, this mindset. I never thought about it in this way of part. And when I say I never thought, it's I was reading multiple books about this, but before that, Peter, what's your call on this one?
Again, this is just me being in different industries prior to this, but I mean, I've seen everything from like one of the clients we used to work with before, not clients, I was employed by them. Part of the process that we had was not just regular the DevOps stuff we talked about before, but it was also just making sure that an example would be having somebody on the team who can understand the difference between like the different types of ways that you can post data, like through HTTP methods. And then sometimes, things that we were catching as this more security aspect of stuff is just looking at the software from that standpoint. It was catching people who were developers who thought it was okay to have a form that was on a website where you hit submit and it was passing username and parameters or username and passwords as URL parameters because it was a GET method. And, they're sending it across with basically exposing raw passwords, and it just conceptually it worked functionally, when they were developing these things, but like you're exposing private, secure data for the customer. Just even from that all the way to things like just how companies are, or if they're setting up behind VPNs or there are certain aspects of this that get into like people working in open Wi-Fi spaces that have accessing public Wi-Fi over networking and things like that might be or even just like making sure that you're reading. I've recently had to do this with somebody. They were like, oh, there's this really great free VPN software that I can just use. And I was like, well, did you read their terms of service? Because it probably mentions something about like any traffic or data that's sent through their systems they get to use. And if you're uploading code and all the rest of the stuff for proprietary software, I'm like, you're essentially giving them permission that if they have where to get access to it because you use it through their system. Definitely pay attention to that stuff. And so there's not a normal mindset for DevOps stuff, but for the security aspect of stuff, absolutely penetration tests, all the rest of that. But even those other aspects of things, just from somebody who can check network requests who's a developer all the way up to more of like, more company security stuff and making sure that people are actually being protected and not accidentally leaking out confidential intellectual property.
You remind me of my student story when I had a project and I had to do some application, web application. And to simplify my work, I use GET protocol for everything. Sending data, personal data, other stuff. And then, I submitted the work. And then the professor was like, yeah, you made it, but I have a concern. Why are you just using this one? I said, it works. And he said, what if you will be in a public network, right? You sit in someone maybe, scanning all the... for the requests, you don't encrypt them, right? You're not using POST, so anyone can read them. I said, yeah, but it's just a project. But what if you will go to production? I will do differently. And he was like, yeah, but that's actually the goal of our student project, that you have to learn how you would do in production and not how you will hack right now. But yeah, it's a good part of the security that hit me.
Yeah, a lot of people don't realize that when they're doing those network calls like that, that they go into a router and a router has like a log of requests that could be made. And so any of that stuff can actually just be, if you're at a public coffee shop or something like that, like all that for sure can definitely go in some log somewhere. So any of those URLs that get sent over or metadata, as Facebook likes to call it, like you get to make sure that stuff is solid. So for sure.
Yeah, how much of us thinking about this when we are designing commerce cloud architectures and like websites for our customers? I hope most of us do this, but I mean, it's not the first thing that you think, right? First time.
This is 100% why I volunteered to do PR reviews for everyone as the lead engineer person on my team. I'm like, I'll look at everyone's code because I've got weird background experience. So yeah, there's fortunately a lot of this stuff's already taken care of. Yeah. Not that big of a deal.
Yeah, the platform has made strides in security.
Absolutely,
yeah. HTTPS everywhere a few years ago was a monumental change in that direction to avoid a lot of that. But yes, we all need to be cognizant of security risks in our code reviews and in our code development. And imagine any code you write will hit production, hit customer browsers. Absolutely.
Back on that time when Salesforce introduced HTTPS, I was working for SF, and I remember that it was like, why are you forced to switch to HTTPS? It's not working. Some stuff is not working. I was like, Guys, it's not where you have to focus. It's actually a good part that we have to switch to that one and not like stuck on the old one. We have to think positively, right, in the secure way. And for that one, I actually wanted to go back to the idea that I was talking about the books. So I have three books that I love about the DevOps. And I guess, Kyle, you're actually the one that proposed them as well to talk about today as, you know, as a reference. But those are like the Phonics Project, the DevOps Handbook, and the Unicorn Project. And I love them. Usually people read either Unicorn Project or the Phonics Project, right? And not both of them. And when I finished both books, I said, no, we need to read both of them because both cover the sides of different story, right? So what's your call on this one?
Well, I love the Phonics Project. It's what introduced me, I think, more thoroughly to DevOps. It put it more in my vernacular. I was passionate about continuous integration generally, but not DevOps as a whole. I read the Phonics Project, and that was a nice experience for me. It changed the way I thought about DevOps and about software development as a whole. And I think that one came first. It was written by several authors. The DevOps Handbook was written by some of the same authors. And then I think the Unicorn Project was very recent, just in the last year or two, and was written by one of the authors, Gene Kim. He was involved in all three. I might rank them in that order just because of the chronology of it and the fondness and the mark it left on me was most significant early on, just for that simple reason. But I do like all three.
Okay, so which one you would recommend to people? Let's say if I have to choose one of three of them, which one that would be?
I would choose the Phonics Project for anyone in software development. Maybe if you're very focused on web and SFCC, probably the Unicorn Project is a little more relevant because it's about digital and it's actually about e-commerce. It's about an e-commerce website.
Yeah, I love the story from the book when they were like doing that promotion stuff. And I was like, I remember the review on Amazon and someone said, yeah, this is a fairy tale. You cannot do this in 3 months. And I was like, yeah, it's actually, it looks impossible to achieve, but let's not focus on what they did, but the concept they applied into the book. And the books actually talks about those ways, right? First way, second way, third way. What are those ways like?
Yeah, maybe we can set the stage a little bit more for people who aren't familiar with the books too. And
oh yeah, sure. Let's go.
We asked you before if you were familiar with them and you weren't. The books that I've given to some of my new employees, just because I love them when I onboard them. The Phonics Project and the Unicorn Project are actually novels. They're novels about that anybody in the software development industry will relate to. They've been there. They've been in bad projects that go on forever with no clear goals and unrealistic timelines and ambiguous expectations and frustrating weeks of work without moving the needle for the business. And business is at risk, and that's kind of the setting. And how do we improve that? How do we align our technology operations and our software development operations to meet the business's needs? Because we're in a business crisis here. And that's kind of the backdrop of the Phonics Project and the Unicorn Project. And it takes, you know, from the perspective of people on the ground. I think in the Phonics Project, if I remember right, it's a director who's promoted to VP of technology or of operations, I think, actually. And you know, he's working with his new team to figure out a lot of problems. And then in the Unicorn Project, it's a very senior, like a principal developer on their app and web space, if I remember right. So, you know, kind of ground level perspective of how to engage in DevOps and make a positive change in their companies. The DevOps Handbook, in contrast, is nonfiction. And it's more, here are the actual principles and things that you can apply. It's a companion book to the Phonics Project. That's how they market it. It's a companion book to the Phonics Project. But it's much more like a software development book as opposed to a novel.
Agree. I totally agree. I mean, when I was actually reading the Unicorn Project, I was thinking about my projects, really. I was reflecting all the stuff that we had in terms like when we have a new customer to Salesforce and how I would change the way how we were operating the project if I would, you know, read this book before, like if all the stakeholders of our project would read it and like maybe we would drive it in a totally different way, right? Because it's not just okay, like those waterfall projects where you kick off everything and you don't think about the operations, but what before even the project start, you starting to think about operations and how you're actually going to run this one.
I mean, that's where the term DevOps came from. There's this 2009 talk that was given by folks from Flickr. Do you all remember Flickr?
Yeah, I remember Flickr.
Yeah. And they gave this, what's considered a real seminal presentation, 10 plus deploys per day. At the time, that was thought to be groundbreaking. And in our SFCC ecosystem, that would be groundbreaking. You know, I don't know of anybody who's doing more than one deploy per day. I don't know of anybody who's doing much more than one deploy per week. So, you know, back then it was really thought to be groundbreaking. They kind of wanted to change the mindset of development versus operations. Instead of operations trying to resist change to protect the status quo and to protect customers, and developers trying to introduce change to move the business, like get together, find mutual common ground. We're all on the same side as the business. See this flow from each other's eyes, and DevOps was born. That's kind of my understanding of it anyway. These books take that and provide a framework to think about how to apply DevOps to your daily life. And so getting back to your question from a few minutes ago, like the three ways, they talk about the first way, flow, which is just providing quality work from left to right as quickly as possible and as efficiently and as high of quality as possible. It takes a lot of principles from the lean manufacturing movement. The second way, Gene Kim et al. Describe as feedback, amplifying feedback loops. And then the third way is continual learning and experimentation. At least that's what I remember them to be. Somebody listening to this podcast is probably going to jump in and correct me. It's been a few years since I read the books, but that's what I remember. And I think of that last one kind of as fun, just to be alliterate, flow, feedback, and fun, because learning and experimenting is fun. And these are frameworks that help me think about how we can apply DevOps to Salesforce Commerce Cloud, because it's not easy. We have some constraints in our platform. But I want to keep moving the needle for my customers, for our customers, Astound's customers, to this, because I do believe it's the right way to build software.
I have one story that I would like to share exactly about how to apply that one. And the idea in Commerce Cloud was how to get everyone who is new to Commerce Cloud to know the platform faster. And not only to know the platform, but get used to the future that will happen in a few months, right? The future will be they will have a new website on Commerce Cloud. They will have to operate this website. What we can do? The idea was to apply first, from the methodology standpoint, Agile. Second one was to apply DevOps. And I'm that believer that think that Agile and DevOps, they stick together. They help each other. So what we did is like every sprint production ready solution, right? And by that, what it means that every sprint we would deliver to production solution. That would mean that even if we build in the feature, we're thinking about production configurations, we're thinking about production systems, we're thinking about how business would actually operate this feature, right? User manuals, other stuff. And then each sprint, we would actually like trying to codify configurations, version them, like it would be, you know, live website and we would have a normal release, right? Like the support team would do. But this was a delivery team who usually not familiar with those processes because they usually just build this website. But this team would actually codify data, codify code, make it production ready, user manuals, make a demo to the end user, to the business team, right? They will show what they built, get some feedback and see, okay, are you guys satisfied to go it this way? Yeah, you have some feedbacks. Maybe we can incorporate it in the next cycle of the process, right? And they will say, yeah, of course. And then we move it, right? You make a build to staging. You make a smoke test over there. Like, so you want to save the time. So you write some automated tests and then you replicate to production. So every sprint, we actually push to production some code. We had some obstacles, like some other production system were not ready for such kind of methodology. Because let's just imagine payment, right? Maybe in the legacy system, you're already using CyberSource for payment. You cannot switch, you know, to new product, like that existing one to the new one, if you're not applying some shadowing principles. But that actually was one of those flow way applied on the real project, where we actually were focusing on production ready solution with every cycle. And with that, all the DevOps concepts also were applied. We had to automate as much as possible because we need to push, right? We don't have time each week to spend hours by our QAs to test the golden flow or like happy pass, right? How you can call it, like those regression tests. You don't want to do smoke tests, right? I don't want to test every time if my user, I can create a user. If I edit, I don't know, maybe some CRM check if such user already exists in the internal system. I want this to be automated. The same would be with the code reviews, right? If we are trying to bring some value for the business, I don't want to waste my time on the code reviews. In the code reviews, I just want to understand, let's say, some conceptual architecture stuff were done. I don't want to check if someone missed comma or like he used the proper, you know, name for the variable. I want automated tools to be there. So we applied also automated tools in the code review process where we could analyze some stuff, you know, and save the time for everyone. And I guess for me, it was, I have this, I call it my prime experience project where like everything worked in the best way. Of course, we have challenges, but from DevOps perspective, it was the best project in my life because we were able to codify, let's say, 99% of the data, and we almost didn't have to do any manual changes during deployment on development stage and production instance. Any stories?
That's fantastic. I mean, that's something I've aimed for on a couple of projects in my past, and you know, putting configuration as code in the repository is a challenge because, for one part, working in Salesforce Commerce Cloud, we have people who need to go into Business Manager and merchandise their websites. So just the simple exercise is not simple at all. The exercise of differentiating which data belongs to DevOps and which data belongs to the merchandising team is step one. And it wasn't even easy for we, Astound Commerce, and our client to agree on that, because the client had two teams. You know, they had three teams. They had digital, they had IT, and they had you know, the merchandising team. So even that step one was difficult. Then actual implementation of that. Okay, now we've decided what belongs in the scope of DevOps. We're going to put that in our repository. We're going to put that into source control and put that as part of our build process. That was step two, and that was hard. So that's tremendous that you achieved that. And it's something that I continue to strive for in my projects.
Okay, that was a success story. I know, like, also kind of success story, but not that much, where not everything was codified. And that was the background for that one. Business. That's a very large organization with a lot of business units across the globe, a lot of brands, a lot of countries, right? And really diverse organization. And if such a diverse organization actually managing, let's say, let's speak about Realm, right? You have one Realm, but imagine you have different brands over there. And one brand is another business team, another merchandising team, because they sell different stuff, right? They have another marketing strategies. So that was a challenge where we find out that actually trying to apply codified data, it's over-engineering, doesn't bring any value, because every team wanted to manage in their own way. And we said, okay, then let's move it. Let's just be there. How we can help us? What we needed was actually snapshots of the data, sometimes to help developers. We said, okay, with our codified DevOps, we are not going to help the business team, but we wish to help at least delivery team to have a better approach. When you wanted to help the delivery team, you could have the snapshots of their changes, because usually how you have it is like someone making new product, other stuff, and then something not working in production, right? And then they give it to you and say, oh, you have a bug in your delivery. And then you said, okay, let's see what happened. So you want to get that snapshot of the latest configurations, and that where we actually spend time in the DevOps to pull automatically the data from those instances and codify them in the data that would be deployed to the sandboxes. Then every morning developer come to his, you know, to his instance, he would potentially run this command to synchronize the data, would just pull the data and push to his sandbox. So he has the latest version of the data he has to work with.
If I were to map that to our reading, Oleg, that's creation of on-demand production-like environments for every developer. You achieve that. So tremendous, good job, because that is the source of so much pain in our projects when we can't do that. When we have sandboxes that are far away data-wise and code-wise from production, we're not able to debug issues, we're not able to get moving faster. That's very often one of the first constraints we try to relax. try to exploit in some cases. The books talk about the theory of constraints, which I love. Production-like environment is always, almost always my first constraint. I can like, remove that. So the theory of constraints, as I understand it, is you know, talked about it. I don't think it originated from these books, but the books talk about it. Is that in your development process, you can actually only have one constraint at a time. And they have a nice visual of it. It's like I think of a balloon animal bubble, and you pinched it in one part. That's your constraint. Anything else isn't actually your constraint. So just identifying your one thinnest point and working on fixing that one at a time and just iterating on that will improve your flow. Because the theory goes, if you improve any other point in your balloon animal, you haven't really improved your balloon animal at all. You still have this pinch here. If you do it beforehand, you're just making that bottleneck that much more severe. And if you do it after, you're starving that benefit you took time to invest in because it's not getting the resources it needs to improve. So my first go-to, like how do we improve our workflow, get production-like environments, get our data in the repository into source control. And that's something I'm really passionate about.
Yeah, I can agree with you there. Actually, I was going to share a story that was with the current client. I can remain anonymous. and we have an issue. So in case anyone's listening, they don't know this. There is an SFCC CLI tool that lets you do data importing where you can set up your sandbox and have a repository with a folder called data and that you can actually have like imports that will make all your sandboxes consistent and all that good stuff. And you can definitely make that part of your deployment process local or, you know, so that you're submitting PRs and things like that. An interesting obstacle with that is that you kind of have to figure out as a team how you want to handle it. Cause it's, you know, you can do things like site preferences and configurations and things like that, but you're also going to need things like services. And for people who are integrating services, like if you're doing a full normal export, it doesn't contain password information. And then even if you were to create one that might have it, then you run into another issue where there's some third-party services, I think like Turn2 is one, I think it's them, but where they have like per sandbox webhook URL configurations that need to have their own API keys and credentials per sandbox. So you can't really use data there. So then you have to start to kind of re-architect like, okay, well, how do we balance this internally with having, you know, something that does allow us to have like a kind of like a shared environment where anyone who works on adding a new site preference, we can deploy that as part of a repository. It's in the code base, but these other services would get wiped out if we don't do that. So it's definitely kind of like architect level role at that point to kind of figure out like what the overall goal of the project is and then how to integrate with the developers and then figure that stuff out. So that's been a recent challenge of ours is just figuring that out. And then also follow up on that one, unless Kyle wanted to have a comment on it. But another recent challenge that we had was when we switched over from the old, or basically when some on-demand sandboxes became a thing, a lot of clients had issues with their products. I think there's like a 10 gigabyte limit per sandbox for these on-demand sandboxes. And so you can't just export all of your product data anymore from, you know, staging or whatever, because there's just a hard limit of how much data that you can actually fit on these on-demand sandboxes. So if you've got a catalog with hundreds of thousands of products and images and things like that, there's nothing you can do. So Salesforce does have a tool that's called Catalog Reducer that you can go through and cherry pick. There's an interesting aspect of that is it is random and it randomly picks, you know, from the different products that you've got. So you run into these really interesting issues kind of like from the DevOps perspective of like, well, what if we have a product that's got multiple swatches or multiple colors? What are the likelihood that I actually had randomly exported things from these catalog reducers that are that actually exported a product that does have more than one variant set on there? Or do we have to like manually do that? And even if you do use a catalog reducer, then there's tooling that needs to be developed to do things like price books and inventory, because now you've got this catalog that got exported that doesn't actually have any other data that's kind of required. And it was randomly generated. So you kind of need to also randomly generate that same set of data for those other things that you need to import. So for Redvan, that's some of the tooling that I did was like supplementing the stuff that was already out there, which was the catalog, you know, reducer for on-demand sandboxes, So that's something that can actually generate the imports that you need for price books and inventory and things like that. So it just, you pull in your XML file for the catalog that you randomly created, and it spits out these other ones for you so you can import those as well. So a lot of that was just tooling that gets created for this DevOps process of like, how do we spin up a sandbox in a way that people can actually like consistently use it, but also like has actual kind of real data, but not all of it, because we can't have all of it, like, because there's a limit. So this is totally a fun world to be in.
Absolutely. We've worked with the catalog reducer too, and we've experimented a little bit. We're not ready to, you know, productize it fully even internally, but an idea we have that we've been working on a little bit as we have time, which who has time these days, right? It's one of the issues with DevOps as a whole, but like taking that catalog reducer idea and instead of random, give us something that's useful. And what do we need as developers? We probably need a category or two that's fully fleshed out with the whole category there, so I can test load more functionality or pagination functionality, whatever my website might have. And then I also need the breadth of the site catalog. I need every category there so I can test my mega menu, and make sure my mega menu reflects what's in production. So that's the idea in short, is give us the ability to configure, I want these three full categories and I want one product of every other category. Give that to my developers as a starting point. And then exactly like you did, we did do this, is take that inventory and price book files that we need that matches that site catalog and get that imported as well. And that's an effort. And I think if we get to the point where it's really fully product ready, I would be a proponent of, you know, incorporating that and submitting that as a pull request into Catalog Reducer. I'm a fan of open source in general. Just depends on how much we consider that astound commerce intellectual property. So I can't make any promises there.
Oh, yeah. Well, and there's also just like even shared library things. The other issue you get into is just product images and things like that. And so once you get one sandbox set up, so one of the things that I helped internally try to write some code for is there's something called rsync, which is like a server thing, but there's a web dev version of that that actually lets you through command line. If anyone is not familiar with, like, normally pulling a file from web dev and then getting it set up on your server, it has to like look at the file tree for everything, and then so sometimes like just even loading the file structure, like to see which files are there, can take forever. So if you're trying to quickly transfer something from one instance to another, there's something out there called rsync that supports web dev that actually does file checks like automatically, so it can actually do correct like syncing without having to do a full tree indexing. So it actually, like, if you had thousands and thousands of files and you're only missing one, it takes like a fraction of a second for it to copy that over. You don't have to wait for hours for it to try to like manually copy over everything and you're just sitting there waiting. But you can also set it up to automate for everything. You can say, I've got one sandbox, but there's 10 members on my team and they're all starting on this project brand new. Like, how do I get all these assets on all of these sandboxes at the same time? Like, you can actually run all that in command line too. You just set up a configuration file for each one and then you just run a command and it dispatches all the stuff automatically to everything. It's pretty sweet. So there's definitely a huge opportunity to make some really good tooling for this DevOps stuff, but then you really only need it for very specific instances. But when you don't have it, it's like, it, you know, you can spend days sometimes spinning up a new sandbox with a client that doesn't have a catalog that could fit on there, and you have to like figure it out and get it all going. And then once you get one set up, you're like, okay, now I guess we need to duplicate this and figure out the process to support other developers and maybe new ones that come on in the future. Like, how do we regulate that? How do we make sure that they're getting the most recent data? And like, do we do regular back like exports for them to import and make sure that it's global so that they can import it from a realm? Like, lots of choices that have to be figured out on that stuff.
I have two solutions in terms of the cases that you discussed, because we actually applied them for the folders and services. You are totally right. The issue that I had is actually on-demand sandboxes. The encryption mechanism of that on-demand sandbox is different from your pig, right? So if you like export the service and you have XML and you're trying to import it into your primary instance, it most likely will not work. So like, we had this issue that the hashing was not actually working. So the guys were telling, oh, I'm exported like the proper password, but it's not working on the instance. So then with some investigation, found out that the hashing not usually, you know, matches, right? So if you have the regular sandboxes and on-demand sandboxes, even those, if you have a program and both of them, if you share those files between two of them, they will actually not work because the hashing mechanism is different on both of those sandboxes. So what we ended up is we had those not only the deployment on when you like stored, like you said, the files, like we have like folders. We had the folders. And then in the DevOps pipeline, we knew which folder to use. Let's say you wanted to generate some service, new service, right? And I'm developing new service on-demand sandbox. So I would have then to go to the normal sandbox and just export the file so I can include it into the repository. So anyone else would, you know, would just get it. But that was just an idea. The main idea was like to split into different folders, different kind of data. We, for example, knew that, let's say we didn't want the job run all the time on development, right? But if you want to do production ready job configuration, you need to set the schedule enabler. And there is no scope like production stage and development like you have with preferences. With the job, it's just one scope, enabled or disabled. So we had to create two folders. One would be with the jobs, the same configuration, but it would be disabled. And then it would be another job in production that would be enabled, like with the folders. And then if I'm doing the pipeline build, I would actually pull the data from one folder or another. And in this way, we had like a big complex structure of different folders. And I would say that for different customers, it would be different structure based on their requirements, right? But the idea would be still the same that, yes, you have to have some differentiator between the data that you're pushing to the instance. It's like sometimes you have this code line in your code, like, is it production instance? Don't run, right? Sometimes we want to have some code that is in the development only or like sandboxes, but we don't want this to be run in production. So you write this like, is production? No, don't run on production, right? So it's similar concept over here. And next one was with the images, right? With the images, we use remote images. So we said, okay, development is under CDN, right? All merchandisers actually working on staging or like development instance, and then you can replicate, right? So all the images are over there that customers want to use. Why to store them on sandboxes? Just use remote connections. You can, out of the box for the catalog, you can use remote images from another instance. So we used that out of the box configuration to use all the images from development, which are under CDN. So we don't store any images on sandboxes. Then we went a bit further. We said, okay, but we have static content. We also don't want to keep it on sandboxes. We want sandboxes to be very light. So we did some code changes and configuration. So then we could also use remote images from the development again. So you would actually upload some images on your sandbox only if you are developing some very new content and you want to see how it works. But then within the release cycle where you move your changes to the other instances, you would have this like one-time import folders that would take that image and push to the development, and then, you know, other guy would just remove it from his sandbox.
Oleg, I'm so glad I joined this podcast. You might have just solved a problem I was working on a week or two ago, because we were creating a rental realm for a customer for load testing, performance testing, getting ready for the holiday, right? A lot of customers are doing that right now. We're talking in early October. I think this podcast goes live later, but you know, we're getting ready for holiday testing, and getting product images to load into the rental room was very difficult. They had a huge catalog, massive amount of product images. We tried to point the remote images to production images, but that file pattern wasn't consistent because the production CDN introduces alphanumeric folders in the middle of it that isn't consistent at all. There's no pattern to follow. But I think what you're saying is we could use development instead, where there is a consistent file pattern. We can use remote file paths for product images. I'm going to look like a genius at work tomorrow. Thank you, Oleg.
No worries. I hope it will work for you. But I must say that for us, it was pretty well. The only thing we had actually to do is not only like, you know, setup architecture, it was also education. So we had to educate everyone, because the biggest challenge actually for DevOps for me was to get the business buy-in to do that one. And I guess it's this part of second one, the feedback, right? When you wanted to get the feedback from your end users. So we had our business team. And first we had to sell them the idea, like why it's actually useful. And the best part for us, that for the business, usually when we were like, I was actually successful to apply DevOps, that business wants speed to market, speed to value, right? It was about faster feedback. They want to learn. They want to try something quickly maybe even kill it before go to production just to know that it's not going to work, right? Or like just A-B test it on some, maybe I'm going too far. But anyway, the idea was like that feedback that we want to get. So we showed the business how it can work. And then we every sprint we're getting the feedback, what works, what didn't. Initially, we said that everything will be through the code, like no data changes through the BM. Like if you want to change something, you make it kind of a ticket. You say, when you want to change, and then someone from the team would, you know, codify that change, and then we make the deployments. The feedback was, no, guys, it's not going to work. We need the freedom to do some changes. We said, okay, what freedom do you need? Full freedom. Now, guys, this will not work. What freedom exactly do you need here, right? And then we had several discussions, and so, okay, people, merchandising team usually need access to the content, promotions, right? Like they want to have flexibility on campaigns, promotion they want to configure. Based on the business, sometimes maybe it's very frequent releases of new products, but most cases where I work with, new products come like once a year, once, you know, it's not that often. Like there are some businesses that actually release their product every month, right? So like even, I don't know, maybe even more frequent. But the idea was that we had to align what usually doesn't change and what frequently change. And with that mind, we were able to say, okay, what doesn't change that much frequently, we codify this data. What you need, real flexibility, you have this flexibility, but we just need a process to synchronize this data so everyone has the latest vision. And we don't want to like backup all the time every data and synchronize with it. We would just want to know what is over there. So we found the process where like each sprint, right? Business team would just tell us what changed. I guess it was not the idea. It was not fully automated, but it worked for us because we knew, okay, new campaigns, new promotions, new content. We didn't need to know which content. We already like would have a tool that would export, make a div, and merge it. But at least it was easier for even for the team when they start a new cycle. They knew, okay, there is new campaign, there are new promotions. So if I run my sandbox and I will see something new, I'll like, you know, I'm not surprised that, oh, I didn't see that new banner on the homepage. Wow, why? What is here? Like, new campaign, new promotions? I didn't do anything, right? That would actually help us to have this like a feedback loop. But Peter, Kai, like what for you are those feedback loops? So maybe you have, you know, I feel like I spoke too much right now.
I actually had a question. It's kind of related, but not really. So if Kyle has a response first, I'll give him a window. Otherwise, I'll chime in. All right. So I had a related to this feedback loop. One of the issues that we've got is more just developers trying not to step on each other's toes. And so we've got like, and I'm personally would love to hear Kyle and Olag, if you've got a solution for this specific problem, because it's definitely a DevOps related thing. But so anytime like if you know, developers working on a sandbox, somebody externally had merged in a new cartridge and the code path or your, you know, cartridge path has changed, or some new custom site preference that for whatever reason didn't get it into a data import, or your you know, in our case the client just decided that those data imports are kind of more of a problem than a solution. And so you run into these sometimes situations where you pull down the latest development branch and then everything's broken, or you go to a specific page and something's just tanked. And then you have to figure out like what happened. And it's almost always somebody created a custom preference or a site, you know, something or a new object that needed to get imported and it didn't get imported. And so other than just having some like communication issues, that sounds like that's it. Is there an actual like real solution for that, or what do you guys do for that problem?
I think there is a solution to that. It is partially a culture change. You kind of hit upon it. Data imports being the problem, it is the solution. It's part of your build process, even for sandboxes, and you have that configuration in code. So you follow the site template structure from Salesforce. Like when you do a site export, there's this very specific prescribed folder structure for your sites and for the preferences that belong to the sites and all those kinds of things. Get that in your code base, get that in your repository, get that into source control. And when your developers are developing new features that require those, they have to change some XML to get that in there as part of the pull request. And ideally, if you matured in your DevOps and continuous integration practice, you also have automated unit tests and integration tests that do some very specific and simple checks on those site preferences. You can have some very, very simple unit tests that check for mocked versions of those site preferences, and then integration tests that will actually go in and look at what actually was built to the sandbox and make sure that it's set appropriately. And you know, fail your daily build if that doesn't go well. And that's the kind of automation data imports that resolves those problems. But it is a culture shift. It's a training exercise too. People need to learn about site imports in some cases. It's not part of B2C commerce developer training, as far as I know. And they also need to learn about just that unit testing and automated testing. They're in SFRA, but they're also not trained by Salesforce. So people need to learn Mocha and Chai or whatever right. You know, job compatible automated testing framework you're using.
Yeah, I definitely hear you on the cultural aspect of it, because it seems like a lot of issues now is just like if there was some consistency internally that like people knew to pull it down, like just to even run the data stuff. But there's also, I feel like, a balance between like sometimes the client wants to move very quickly, and so there's that technical debt of like, well, we didn't bother to spend the time doing the actual setting up unit tests and making sure that all these things aren't going to stab us on, you know, as we move. But it's kind of like trying to build a plane while you're flying it, kind of thing. So there's a balancing act sometimes with that. But yeah, I hear you.
In the larger digital ecosystem, there are plenty of case studies that show that investment is painful budget-wise. Invest in continuous integration, invest in DevOps, but it proves fruitful. And I would say among the projects I'm involved with at Astound Commerce, and we have a lot of Salesforce Commerce Cloud customers, less than half of them are very interested in investing extra to do this kind of thing. They have their bottom line. They're retailers. They're not software companies. They want a website to sell their actual product. And so I get that. But some of these customers do want to move very fast, and they recognize that to move fast, they need to slow down. Slow down to move fast. So slow down, build this infrastructure, build DevOps. And then, you know, 6 months, 1 year, 2 years down the line, we're really humming. We're able to introduce new features much more quickly if we've taken the time to invest in continuous integration practices, automated testing, and DevOps as a whole.
For your situation, Peter, I have a practical case what we did. That was one when I actually played with Docker a bit, because I wanted to unify kind of the build process where you can, whatever you run on CI/CD tool could be also run on your local environment. And that when I like was actually putting my head in, okay, no matter what environment I have, how I actually get my site running, right? How I would issue sandbox, okay? Then SFCCI, I have SFCCI, let me do that one too. Create a new sandbox. Then how I get the code, right? Okay, I need some credentials. Fine. Then I do the stuff. And that was like continuous learning to learn the stuff. And then when I learned that, okay, how actually developers pushing the data changes to the sandboxes? Usually they go to the folder, to the BM, click like the button, you know, or hide the folder on their local and trying to do. Less percentage of those developers might use some common CLI commands to push the data, right, to a high full folder and push it. What I did, I actually codified with the JavaScript the script that would push the delta. And I codified it with very simple command, npm run sync. That's it. It was like my custom command. Behind it, every developer knew that after he's putting the latest develop branch, he needs to run npm run sync. What it would do, it would take all the data that it has and push like a delta, right? It will push the delta changes to his sandbox. The idea was following. So as I'm developer and I know that I'm using this command, I know that each time I have to prepare for others the same command, because I know that, okay, like if I'm pulling the data, I'm expecting that all the latest data are over there, right? So doing this small step, even without the unit test, you're already trying to incorporate this culture to let me put myself into shoes of other teammates, because they, like everyone knows that everyone run this npm run sync after they pull the develop branch. That was like one step. Then we find out, okay, it's not all the time working. Sometimes people forget to, as Kyle mentioned, right, to incorporate. You need some tests. What we did, it was like a next step. Some unit tests, other stuff, but again, not everything worked well. So what we did was like, okay, what if I have my golden test, right? I already have my automation golden test, functional tests that are running by, I don't know, Cucumber or Selenium, whatever QA stuff you're using, right? I have my sandbox running. I can run my tests and see if everything's working. So at least we wanted to ensure that if anyone doing some changes, that one not broken. We did this Docker kind of stuff when pull request is raised. So when pull request is raised, we would issue the new sandbox. We would run all those deployment stuff to that sandbox. We would run those functional tests on the sandbox, see if everything's working. Test pass, pull request approved, kind of, you know, this kind of stuff. And that's it. Not everything was tested, but happy pass was tested. It's just enough, you know, for everyone. Then you would review the code with other linters and approve it. And that would be, you know, another way. So I guess it's as Kyle mentioned, it's a culture, but culture, you know, that's from, in my experience, doesn't come just, you know, randomly. You have to cultivate this culture. You have to put some stuff like trying to create those kind of situations where everyone will put himself into the shoes of others. He would have similar expectations, and then he would try, you know, to, I guess we are like, we came naturally to this third way, continual learning and experimentation, right? This is where we are right now, right? That people trying to learn some stuff, experiment with those kind of stuff, you know, and cultivate the culture of the DevOps.
The idea being, like, once you've established the first way flow, and you're very efficiently providing value, and once you've improved the second way feedback, which I don't think we got into too much. Like, it feels like we were still talking a lot about flow. Like, automated testing, I consider part of flow. Feedback is like how to very efficiently raise the alarms when something goes wrong, before something goes wrong even. And Peter, before the call, you told me that you're wearing a fireman's hat at work all the time because things are on fire sometimes. Like, I'd love to see the fireman's hat if you don't mind. And then, like, what can you do to avoid wearing the fireman's hat? That's feedback. What alerts do you need before you have to put the hat on? That's the idea of feedback.
Yeah, well, for sure the fireman's hat, which I do have. Let me, this is it. And for anyone who's actually watching this anyway, I do have, it's a custom developer's hat that actually says, there's actually development firefighter.
Nice.
And you can get these custom made or whatever. So usually I put this on and then I've got a background that I can put on for my thing that's got like a little
alert, fire. Alert.
That is,
yeah, it's even got like this little thing I can just be like, wow. So yeah, it's really stupid. But it's also, I'm going to turn this back off. To me, it was important because, like, people get really stressed out, right? I mean, so whenever things start to break, people panic. And when they panic, they make really bad choices a lot of the times. And so having somebody who's, like, going to take a step back and be like, okay, yeah, everything's hit the fan, you know, like, but let's figure this out. Like, we need to kind of have somebody who power through it and then try to get things solved quickly. And it's a really hard thing to do when everyone's, like, pointing fingers and, you know, that's not helpful. So, but yeah, everything we just talked about right now is a lot of the, you know, like when somebody's trying to deploy something and there's something that needs to immediately go out to staging because something's busted, but they just try to pull down develop and then nothing's working for them, or they can't even get through a checkout properly because somebody changed something and then didn't get turned on. And then it's just like, you know, kind of all hell breaks loose. And so figuring that out and knowing how to debug it and like what tools do you use? What are the best tools for, in some situations are slightly different, but, you know, just kind of being a more seasoned person with that, it's that's the putting out the fires, but preventing them most of the time is knowing the things that are going to cause those problems, which is one of them, right? So like not having time like ahead of time to know that you're doing stuff that's like Kyle suggested, where you are setting up actual correct processes and you're allocating time as part of architecting a project out to actually prep for this kind of stuff so that you're not you know, shooting yourself in the foot later whenever something does go bad and you just never took, you know, you were like, well, what's the odds of that happening? Let's just, you know, get started. We got a deadline here. Like, you know, we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. And then you end up spending way longer trying to solve problems than it would have taken if you just done it correctly to begin with. So even just like for me, putting like preventing those fires too is also just making sure that processes are fully documented and there's more than one person on the team can actually do that process and say in case they're not there for whatever reason. We got a lot of remote employees these days, so you can't not have one person who's the keystone in the company who's, if whatever, they're sick or something, everything falls apart. Like that, there's all sorts of options there for making sure that that to prevent fires from happening. It's almost always just shared knowledge and better training and better preparation for disasters. But it's like real life in that situation anyway. So
Peter, you hit upon so many principles in the Phoenix Project that you would just love the book.
Yeah.
I mean, you talked about blamelessness. That's talked about explicitly in DevOps principles, even in Flickr's first presentation. They talk about avoiding finger pointiness, they call it. Absolutely spot on. And, you know, I mentioned my definition included the harmony of processes, tools, and people. You putting on a fireman's hat and putting your virtual background to be something on fire, that's a visual signal to everybody. Like, hey, we have something we need to work on now. And you're turning it fun too, which is awesome. So you're exemplifying some DevOps principles unknowingly. And so I can
I will share an actual story where it was not so much unknowingly. It was at one point I worked at a company called answers.com and they had like 50,000 people a second coming in. And this is where, when things went bad, it went bad and expensive very quickly. And so we had a couple, you know, like very senior level people who were more of like had the historic knowledge of how things operated and whatever. But they were also kind of the first to get pulled into pretty much anything that could happen. And so there was a balancing act that happened with them where a lot of the times those core people who had the industry knowledge of the platforms were being pulled in multiple directions when these fires happened. And so people are like panicking. You've got somebody from, you know, the chief revenue officer is like, we're losing money. Like, oh, our stuff's not down. And then you got the, you know, ops person is like, what, you know, I think our site's busted. Like, what's going on? You're the person to talk to. And then you get your dev team who's trying to fix it, hitting them up too at the same time. But really, they just need to be left alone to do their job. So that fireman's hat, actually, the original story from that was at the time that I worked at that company, I had got some of those made with the company's logo on it. And if that person had that on, they were to be left alone because they were in the middle of actually like being putting something out. And if you are trying to pull them, you're preventing them from being able to do the thing that you're actually probably pulling them for to begin with. And so it was a visual indicator that these people can actually just, and so it started off as like, it was more of like an emotional and kind of like, I guess I would say like morale kind of thing. So if someone knows that like things are happening and you're just trying to bring back a little bit of control when things go chaotic like that. But for those people who are putting actual firefighters in those situations, they're putting out the actual company's fire. They need to be able to do their job. And so I was trying to figure out a way internally with a company that's got 150 people and everyone's trying to pull them physically because, you know, we're working in the same office, that they needed to be left alone at this moment. So it's kind of like it started off as a joke idea, like that maybe we could have some sort of way that we can, you know, if you're walking towards their desk or going in their office, you would know to leave them alone right now because they need to be doing this. So I got this, let people know that if they needed it. And like the biggest, brutest, most brutish, you know, guys are coming to my office like all mad and angry. And they just reach over to my desk and grab this thing and walk away. And I was like, okay, apparently they have a fire that they need to go put out, and people would leave them alone, you know. So they'd come in there like, hey, oh, okay. So it was like somehow it was like a safety thing for them. They could do it. And the other thing that I did is after they had the fire came out and they put it back, we had like a little gift bag that had the company's logo on it, and I had cut it and turned it into like a super cape, you know, like that you could wear. So after they were done and they put the fire out, if they wanted that, then they were allowed to use it and had the company's logo on. And they knew that if you saw somebody doing that you basically saved the day. And then, but yeah, the fireman's hat was totally, they still kept those. I left them there at the company. So it's still to this day probably being used, and they probably have no idea that it was me who did those, the company, but it works really well. It does its job. And it, you know, it served its purpose that people know that like things are under control, someone's working on it, and things are fine. So yeah.
If I may, I want to challenge you both. So what do you think Facebook has to do right now with the incident that they had just recently when Mark Wright lost how many, 5 or 7% of his money in stocks, of course, like billions of dollars. What then should happen to the person or people who were in charge of those upgrades? I asking you because I saw one comment on LinkedIn that actually triggered me, and people were like, as they told, they were joking, but for me, it was not even kind of the joke. I couldn't understand this as a joke. They were joking like, hey, yeah, like soon there will be open spot over there. Like you should, you know, apply to the Facebook to get this operation, like operation position. I was like, so what are you saying? That that person will be fired because they did a mistake? What, I mean, does it mean that we are not allowed to make mistakes, or should we have to measure those mistakes by the, you know, the impact that they made? So my challenge here will be like, what you would do now if you would be like head of Facebook, like say Mark, right? With this situation, people who were responsible for the upgrade and when he lost his billion of dollars.
Well, Facebook has parallel challenges slash crises slash fires right now between the whistleblower and their recent major outages. And, you know, based on what the whistleblower has said, I don't know if I could put myself in Mark's shoes in some cases. Like there's just some decisions he's making that are above my pay grade, above 99.99% of the people's pay grade in this world. My thought about outages in general is they're opportunities to learn. They're not opportunities to blame. If, you know, it impacted the business and impacted my customers in such a way that I need to hold people accountable, I'm going to hold myself accountable to and look into the issue. And I feel like it's my responsibility as a manager to correct the issue however I need to. Does that mean firing somebody? That will never be my first choice. It will be improve the process. Assume people are human tomorrow. They're human today. They're going to be human tomorrow. Improve the process, improve the system to alleviate their problem in the future. And if somebody comes to me with some obvious gross negligence or even maliciousness that somebody had, of course, then there's a people problem that needs to be solved. But that's not my go-to.
What about you, Peter? What's your call?
So I have a different, I don't know, probably a different insight on this. So, you know, Facebook is mostly free for people. So as far as the customers are concerned, like, I feel like it's a balancing act because they've got some, you know, at some point there are companies out there, sure, that have like service level agreements with Facebook for, you know, different aspects of their business. And then those customers are going to be impacted, and there's going to be some contract with that customer that says what happens in those situations where if there's a service outage, you know, what repercussions are there. And so all that stuff's outlined. So for those, yeah, that's a very serious thing. I mean, but you know, and the other aspect of it is that people, there's an integrations for in a culture, you know, where this is a platform that people are used to communicate. And when these services go down, they weren't always around, and now they're kind of more integral, and like services that are built on top of that, are kind of relying on those infrastructure to be in place. And so, to me, I kind of share the blame, you know, like if you're a customer in this situation, you know, or the user of Facebook, and you're not really directly paying them, but they're making money off of you, sure. When services go down, you are losing some social kind of revenue currency that you're getting from finding out news and what's going on in the world and that kind of aspect of stuff. But at the end of the day, like, you know, there's probably like what a 99.99 and whatever uptime guarantee, like service that if you actually look at the metrics of the company, that they're probably well within, like if this is an actual Amazon or anything else, their downtime, it's going to be such a small blip on the radar that it's more of just an unfortunate thing. So, you know, with all that in hindsight, like how do you punish somebody for such a small, like, relatively small failure in the scope of things is if it was something intentional, you know, you get to it and you do your research and you figure out what was happening, and then you find out that like this was like an act of like against the company or something like that, sure, you know, like there's penalties for that kind of stuff, and there's usually legal actions within the company that can act on that. This is my old CTO hat, by the way. I've been a CTO of like health organizations and other all sorts of stuff, so there's like procedure for these things, like that people usually have to follow. And the unfortunate side effect of all of this is usually more on the people who are more involved, like emotionally with it, who are the ones pushing the stuff out there on the other social platforms that are not out there. But after, you know, at the end of the day, like the actual business, the business relationships that happen with this stuff, you usually have contingencies and contracts in place. And the ones that failed to do proper preparation for that and 100% relied on, you know, like a Facebook integration for their app to even work or things like that, like, you know, some of this kind of needs to be on them for having contingency backup plans for making sure that their platforms work. And that a lot of that is DevOps related too. Like, what happens if we're using single sign-on solutions for Facebook in our platform and it goes down? Like, can people even get in? Have we considered that? It was like, you know, yeah, those are the ones that are going to be the most vocal right now because their stuff's totally busted. But it's also kind of like, well, I mean, what were you planning to happen in that situation? So yeah, I mean, it's a mixed bag of stuff. I mean, it's chaos at this point, right? It's like when that stuff happens and all the different outcomes that could have possibly happened because of something everyone relies on goes down, it's like, you know, trying to even find somebody to blame at that point is really hard, unless it was something super obvious. But if it, even like the most minute accident, like, you know, somebody committed code that just shut the service down, like that happens, you know, like sometimes even tracking it back down starts to snowball because you have like network throttling and people who are just building up queues, and even trying to shut it down long enough so you can find what's going on, it's just like a challenge on its own. It just snowballs out of control really, really quickly when this kind of stuff happens. So getting to the actual root cause and solving it and turning it back on, making sure everything's okay and hoping that it, you know, that you solve the actual problem, that it doesn't just happen all over again. It's like sometimes it's, you don't get it right either. When you're trying to put out a fire, it just picks up someplace else and you have to like put it out wherever it pops up next. And then you're just, you know, trying to distribute the people who are fixing the problem. So it gets really hard to like place blame at that point and figure out who's, you know, but obviously at the end of the day, a CEO is the one who's accountable for everything. So, you know, people who are trying to say there's going to be new seats available, whoever the different respective tiers are, will probably have some repercussions, but losing their job, I don't think that's appropriate, unless it was something intentional or malicious, like then yeah, get them out of there. Sorry, okay, that was a rant.
No, it's a good one. I mean, yeah. I'm personally like against hunting witches, you know, like that hunting witch kind of stuff. But I guess you hitting the point that we are accountable for our roles and responsibilities in the end of our jobs, right? If one of my accountability was to keep the secure service and I failed, that it might have a consequences. And I'm actually happy, you know, that I guess three of us agreed that firing the person would not be like our first call, but we cannot put it fully out of the table because, okay, anyway. For me, it's silly, you know, like I don't want to do it. It's hard for me even to think about it. That's why I guess I'm architect and I love my stuff, what I'm doing. I don't have to manage people, you know, and think about like think about people. I don't want to, you know, be the person who actually have to fire anyone. That's
right. That's not a good place to be. Yeah, but if it's gross negligence, I should have mentioned that one too. Obviously, if the person didn't do their job because they just weren't qualified for it, and this is a repeated pattern, you know, it's like, then yeah, this is kind of the deciding factor in that case. But if it's the first time and then previously didn't have any issues like this and they've got a good history of this and it was obviously an accident, then, you know, just overkill to try to do anything. But yeah,
if I may, Kyle, I want to ask you, like, what about then the third way, continual learning and experimentation? What does it mean for you?
You know, it's funny, when you introduced this topic, I thought you were going to segue into one of the case studies that the DevOps Handbook talked about. You're laughing. Is that Chaos Monkey at Netflix?
That's one of the great stories.
That's awesome.
Yeah, the DevOps Handbook isn't, like, this is well known, but the idea of intentionally introducing production issues, even outages, just to see how resilient your application is, how resilient your people are. That was mind-blowing back in the day, but Netflix pioneered it, or at least they get credited for pioneering it. And, you know, it's become a pretty big standard in Silicon Valley, at least. What a cool idea. I'm guessing Facebook did some of that too, but maybe their resiliency didn't account for this level of outage to the point where people couldn't like get into the building and key cards not working and things like that we've heard about. for me in the Commerce Cloud landscape, continual learning and experimentation. If I have flow going and I have automated testing and I have feedback really well amplified, I feel safe to experiment. I feel safe to have small releases. I feel safe to have fast releases and to get ideas out there and test them, get them out for a segment of my customers and see with analytics and data how this responds to customers from a business perspective. And then also I have analytics and data to make sure that my releases are stable and really aren't negatively impacting the business. I love some of, and I think this was in the second way, the feedback that the DevOps handbook talked about where they used statistical analyses of page load time, of conversion rates, just for every single release. If suddenly they're measuring after a release, because they're releasing multiple times per day to production, if one of these production releases suddenly changes and negatively impacts their metrics, they automatically roll back. They don't even have a human needing to do it. They just look, there's a standard deviation difference here. My conversion rate went down, a standard deviation lower. We need to roll back that code right away, and their system just does it. That's cool. That gives you the safety to start experimenting with customer experiences and giving them what they want and feel really comfortable doing it and be able to move very fast. And that's where I want to get to in the Commerce Cloud world. You know, Salesforce Commerce Cloud, to push code to production, it has a negative impact on customers in that it wipes out the server cache. And so it's difficult to even imagine deploying more than once per day in the Commerce Cloud world. But I want to get to once per day. I want to get a customer. So if a customer is interested in this and wants to work with me on this, let's work together. I want to get to a place where we are deploying code to production every single day so we can do more continual learning and experimentation. That sounds like a lot of fun to me.
I guess it's a good candidate from the grocery domain, because grocery domain has those, let's say, sometimes daily changes in the way how they want to do more experiments, more fast growing. And if you think about the luxury ones, I guess this is the last place where, you know, like some daily innovation has to happen. But I guess the grocery would be like the best hit over there in terms of the market. And I love the way when you're saying about experiments, I had this experience on my end when we also had a flow, we had a feedback, and then we came up with experiments. Like it was like innovation ideas. Let's test them, do something, run them and see how they go. So one of them was actually, I guess you, not sure if you both know, but those, there is this new concept of quick starts on Commerce Cloud, like 2-3 weeks and you go live, right? So something pretty fine, some simplified flows. And we kind of borrowed that idea and thought, okay, what if it's not this quick start, but we already have some web live sites for our particular customer, for his brand, but he wants to run on the new market. Can we actually come with some MVP that mostly will run on the infrastructure? Maybe we'll just have to implement something, small stuff, but then it will run. So how we can do it? And then we look at the landscape of the business. We found out super common, I mean, every common touches, integrations, features, other stuff that are in place. And we look at that, said, okay, what is different? The only difference was actually evaluate manually payments and logistics, logistic partner. Rest of the business was actually the same. And then we said, okay, fine. Can we actually codify this? Can we just codify the full solution and just say, okay, this will be just only two features that you have to develop? We codified like a template. And that, because why I say a template, because you have to replace with translations, right? You have to codify with form changes, right? Between the countries. And I mean, just simple as that, right? Just some localization and maybe some stuff. So actually codify the pattern to generate fully the website and code base for a particular country, for a particular brand. And then if customer wanted to go for a new market, we actually had this kind of this generation framework that would just, you fill the form, what you want to do, some features, some country, what you have, and it fully generate your site data, code. You would be able just commit these changes and it will pick up by the DevOps. It will deploy in the instance. And I mean, in a matter of like 1 hour, you actually had on your UIT environment ready for testing website for the new country. That was the idea that we, and like we saved thousands of dollars for the customer because of that. Because usually how you would start the projects on, you know, with the customer, right? You're like trying to analyze all the stuff, but we spent kind of this discovery design once for all the countries. We simplified, review all the business, we find out the common grounds. Then we because we already had the DevOps, we already had codified data, we already had codified code. It was easier for us just to extract, you know, and build a pattern across this data. And then just simple generation, you know, like some CLI tool, fill the answers. We even did like the form for the business. So let's have, there is a business owner of the country. You just write to him and say, okay, can you just let us know your business constraint? And he would fill some like Google forms, some kind of Google form stuff. Then we, from this generated CSV, we would actually generate the full website on the sandbox. And we didn't end up using this one for the production ready stuff, but we used this one to onboard new country on Commerce Cloud and on the new product that they would have, because you were able to generate for this new market demo instance where they can go and play with their particular country constraints, with their language, with their forms, right? Like zip code format, like phone numbers, when they can they register. They could already even go to merchandise the stuff in their way, like put some translations and other stuff that they want to do. That was actually like this, at least in my understanding, continual learning experimentation, because we had this kind of, you know, already understanding why DevOps is good. We had this flow, we had the feedback, and then we started to experiment in Commerce Cloud with, you know, with the tools that we had.
Awesome. We were also part of the Quick Start programming, and yeah, it's been very interesting. Yeah.
I mean, that's a great stuff, guys. I mean, when I look at the clock, I see we talked a lot today. I mean, honestly, I was not expecting that it would be such an interesting discussion. And you know, it was hard. In the Harry Potter movie and the book itself, they had these watches, right? And if the sand would go slower, right, it means that we had very interesting discussion, something that I don't exactly recall how it was, but it was some professor who actually thought, what he thought, some magic, right? Defense of magic. Anyway, I'm not sure. It's not about DevOps, but what I was trying to say, that it was very interesting discussion today. So usually, Kyle, look, on every podcast, we have the stuff that I call prime time. And in annotation to our videos, it will be called like, what is your message to the community? So it's your time right now. Like, what is your message to the community?
My message would be to embrace the, if not DevOps itself completely, the principles of DevOps, of safe, fast deployments, writing your code in such a way that you're thinking about your consumer. Sometimes your consumer is the next person on your team in the value stream. Sometimes your consumer is your code reviewer. Sometimes your consumer is your QA tester. Be thinking about them. And they'll be thinking about you too. That's, if we're thinking about each other in this process, that's really at the heart of DevOps. That's why it's one word. We're all on the same teams. And that it can be done. In Salesforce Commerce Cloud, there are some constraints that we all have. Keep identifying your constraint, exploit it or relax it, and improve your development process to the benefit of your client and your client's customers, or your customers themselves if you're on the customer side. It can be done, and let's work together to keep toward that goal.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Peter, before we sign off, any ending message from your end?
No, not really. Just thanking Kyle for his time. I had warned him ahead of time that this is probably going to be a long one, because DevOps, there's a lot to talk about. So, so yeah, that's definitely a lot. Went over. Oh yeah, there's so, I could probably go like 3 or 4 more episodes worth of this just to talk about all this and the amount of great things that are out there. So yeah, thanks for being on here, Kyle.
Thank you,
Kyle. And maybe that's my message too. Like, leave a comment in YouTube or wherever you're listening to this podcast if you want to jump on and talk more DevOps with us. Let's do it. We want to hear from you. I want to hear from as many people as possible about what they're doing that's related to DevOps in the Salesforce Commerce Cloud community.
Absolutely agree. That's a great idea.
Thank you, Kyle. Thank you, Peter. Definitely with both of you. I feel there is so much room for further discussions and sharing the experiences. So guys, yeah, comment, go to an official community, join the podcast channel that we have over there, and just let's continue the discussion that we had today. Thank you everyone for spending your precious time with us today. Thank you, Kyle. It was amazing discussion. Honestly, I love it. I don't know how even the time flew, you know, just right now. It's like, it was just amazing. Thank you very much and see you guys.